The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 22. Madrugada.
"I'm not sure what makes you think I follow the rules ever,"
Severus noted. Minerva had just come from her rest shift. Ron was supposed to go rest now. Both were telling him that he should not have interrupted his sleep and should go now to get some. He refused, claimed he was the headmaster, and later pointed that he didn't usually do what people wanted to begin with.
"It shouldn't be a disappointment or a surprise."
It certainly wasn't a surprise to Luna, or maybe she was always carrying a midnight snack with her. She produced a thermos with a tisane, caffeine-free so he could sleep later, and a couple of sandwiches. One of the Patil sisters had braided her hair, and she was wearing something reminiscent of a sweatshirt with a big happy moon painted in front. It was nighttime, so she wore nighttime clothes, fire and battles notwithstanding.
"If you need anything," Kingsley ventured, and Sampras nodded in his direction, offer acknowledged.
Kingsley could be trusted to steer the ship for a while. He had naturally come to lead the defunct Order of the Phoenix, raising it from its ashes after Dumbledore's death. Moody was more experienced, and Kingsley didn't hesitate to acknowledge it, but Moody lacked the organizational spirit that Kingsley always had. Moody was a natural loner, while Kingsley was like a shepherd's dog. Besides, Moody wasn't a prefect, and he didn't have to keep Gryffindor Tower under control when he was a student. It might sound like a joke, but James Potter used to go to the Forbidden Forest for a stroll from week one of his first year, and Remus Lupin once stole the Grindylow they were supposed to use in DADA class and kept it hidden in his room for 2 weeks. Apparently he thought that while they ought to study the creature, repeatedly hitting it with spells was akin to torture, and after he explained himself to Potter the Elder, he agreed, which is why they kept a Category C monster under their bed for half a month, and Kingsley was the one who had to fix that. Severus was aware of this.
"Maybe in an hour," he told Kingsley.
They were female, that much was very obvious, and intelligent insofar as they seemed to have a language. But they were naked just like animals are naked. Even the Muggleborns Selwyn kept at home were dressed with rags to preserve decency. Not the harpies, though. This was one of those strange cases in which the eye barely rested on the naked figure. Just as people tended to forget that velas could transform into bird-like creatures that threw balls of fire, when confronted with a harpy, most people barely paid attention to their nakedness and instead focused completely on the razor-sharp claws they had instead of hands. Gilray was sniffing the air around the border. She licked a finger and caressed the place where the charms had been cast.
"I smell woman," she said. "She's the one."
Selwyn didn't care who exactly had cast the spell, only that it was broken before sunrise. The harpies, however, seemed to consider this an important fact. Gilray walked up and down the tree line, sniffing, licking, and moaning orgasmically. Coming from her, it did nothing for Selwyn's libido. In fact, he could feel his testicles retreating. One of his acolytes had come to bring him a message about the status of the station, and Selwyn could feel his discomfort even with the mask on.
"Her blood," Gilray said. "Her blood strengthened the spell. I can taste it here."
Her brother Amicus is what she meant, not her actual blood used on the spell. After so many weeks working with her, Selwyn had gotten used to the hag's way of speaking. It was barbaric, but others like Thornton had to work with creatures that were far worse. Gilray assured him that the spell could only be lifted through those who cast it. Otherwise it would remain unbroken, and only time in the shape of centuries could make some damage. Selwyn asked if she meant by. She didn't.
"Speak, my lord," said the hag. "That's all they ask for. Spoils to sate their needs. Just some spoils in exchange for the victory they will bring you."
He thought about it.
"Anything they want as long as it is night," he conceded. "They keep fighting during the day, and during daytime they will get the same rewards as anyone else."
Gilray bowed down. The harpies hissed and opened their wings.
"Where the fuck am I?"
wondered Percy. Since the last few days had been harrying and his mother wasn't around, he felt free to swear. He looked up and down the place. Apparition required focusing on the image of the place you wanted to be, which is why it was impossible apparating to unknown places. Unless, of course, you had previously seen them in a vision, so you could know them even if you had never been there. And there was cold air that made goosebumps on Percy's arms. He turned around. Not over there looked familiar. There wasn't anything like a path, but if he was careful, he could trek down and get to a flatter terrain. From there, it would be easier. He just had to be careful with that heather bush so he didn't trip. Then there would be a lot of excuse me, incoming excuse me, to your left, thank you, and he would be where he had to be. The main doors of Hogwarts were open. Well, not open exactly, because open implies the possibility of being closed, and it wouldn't be possible in this case because the doors had been reduced to a pile of splinters. The body of the giant's chieftain, however, made for a decent obstacle. A line of 5 or 6 wizards could hold the entrance for a long time, so the doors could be said to be open and closed at the same time. However, the giant seemed to have lost all interest in that entrance and had gone back to tearing down the door on the east side. They would never be able to get through it, but Voldemort's observation had been right. It was less defensible, with fewer windows and balconies over it from where they could cast spells. Then there were the reports of werewolves hanging around the forest and attacking the centaurs who had retreated there. The werewolves had precisely the speed and strength required to fight a centaur, but they weren't engaging them much. Just a few skirmishes that seemed designed to draw them away from the castle. They might not even be werewolves, too much human in them, and be some kind of ogres instead. Or so Severus thought. At the moment, he didn't know if he was seeing too much. Maybe the ogre werewolves had no plan or strategy behind their actions. Maybe Voldemort knew that Severus had come to expect duplicity from everyone, and could therefore be defeated with a simple and straightforward plan. That seemed an inordinate amount of awareness on the Dark Lord's part, but perhaps the betrayal had made him cautious. Mostly all this werewolf talk made him think of Remus. He wouldn't necessarily have anything to say at the moment, but Severus could do with him telling him something, anything. He really, really wanted to hear his voice. "They have brought trolls," Arthur Weasley said. Most of the Order had come to naturally join the current shift, although they were having some trouble following or even listening to Snape's orders. Severus didn't take it personally. They had spent months believing him a loyal Death Eater, and he didn't have a high opinion of their mental flexibility. If they had never stopped to question Dumbledore's orders, he couldn't very well expect them to fall in line easily now. They were helping, and that's what mattered. Arthur Weasley, Emmeline Vance, and Nymphadora Tonks were showing to be very amenable to the idea of a good Snape, which doubtlessly was why Kingsley was sending them his way. To this moment, Moody was still calling him a murderer under his breath. "Trolls?" asked Severus. Trolls were like small ramrods, strong and resilient, but hardly the worst thing that could come to their walls.
"How many?"
"About 2 dozen. Most of them are gathered on the north side, under the astronomy tower, a few on the west. I'm told that they can get some good shots from the Gryffindor and Ravenclaw towers, and from the Transfigurations corridor." Arthur spoke with a serenity that was the paragon of British composure. It was exactly the kind of poise that people like Vernon Dursley wished they had and very rarely achieved. Severus supposed that someone who had married Molly Pruitt and had fathered that horde of children had to be unflappable.
"Kingsley has taken some people and his on the north side," Arthur went on. "Flitwick says he is staying on the east and protecting that entrance, even though no giant can fit there. McGonagall is with the others on the west side. They think that casting from the Transfiguration corridor should be enough to stop most of the trolls."
That, Severus thought, was a perfectly sensible plan.
"I am going to be by the entrance," Arthur said. "They could always use an extra one there."
Severus looked at him. His eyes, so dark that passed for black, met the more tranquil blue eyes of Arthur. Everything that had been said was sensible, and yet Severus was quivering with tension.
"Call them back," he said, his voice hoarse with fear. "Call them back, call them back."
"Why, what?"
"I don't know, you fool, just call them back."
It was too late. The Transfiguration corridor was full of blood. On the floor and on the walls against which people were leaning, they were taking it well, however, a deep form of courage that had them taking deep breaths as they checked over their injuries and saw the deep gashes or the missing chunks of flesh. They heard the scream of the harpies again. Minerva and four others, all injured but not severely, cast a blasting curse. They hit one of them right in the stomach, and they saw the harpy fall over the railing and hopefully smash against the floor outside. The others broke the glass in the balcony doors and thrashed around looking for anything to hurt before retreating quickly. They were gone by the time the second hex erupted from their wands.
"Someone take the injured to the infirmary,"
ordered Minerva over her shoulder. She had an open wound on her left arm that she was ignoring because the right arm was her wand arm. Her eyes were fixed on the wide doors to the balcony, seven of them. Some remained closed, most had the glass missing, two of them were completely broken.
"Everyone is injured," cried Dean Thomas. "Everyone but not. Take the ones not arguing back."
The ones with missing limbs, the ones passed out from shock or blood loss. Vincent Crabbe grunted, pushed himself upright, and went to plant himself in front of one of the few untouched doors to the balcony. He stared at it, considering, and kneeled, not without effort. During the next assault, a harpy came flying at full speed through that door, apparently unconcerned by the glass shards and the splinters of wood. Crabbe avoided her claws and hit her with a blasting curse, not too powerful, but strong enough to send her in the way of another one. They crashed together, and neither of them got to slash Cho Chang's throat. Things were quite similar on the northern side. There was blood and broken windows and harpies falling down again and again, seeking entrance. Behind the few wizards and witches who had managed to get back to their feet and were desperately pushing them out, there were the injured, seeing with horror how their lives escaped in gushes through their open wounds. Kingsley had seen one of them hack Tonks's throat, and he thought that in that moment they had ripped his heart out. He had seen it, he was sure he had seen it, but the next second Tonks had shot a lime-green spell and the harpy had pulled back. He couldn't spare the time to turn around, but he knew that Tonks was in the defense line. He could hear her calling the spells in an angry voice rather than casting nonverbally. So she was alive, even if he had thought he had seen her die. He was trying not to think about Tonks or about Emmeline Vance. It had taken them two assaults before they managed to advance the line enough to reach her. Two assaults in which she was lying still on the floor with her chest open and dark blood coming from it. He couldn't think about it because he had formed a defense line, and he had to hold it no matter what. The harpies came again and again, too quick to be hit with spells. They had gotten everyone inside by now, so they couldn't do much more damage. The balcony doors were completely destroyed, but Kingsley would make sure that the harpies didn't get further inside. They had the balcony, he had the corridor and the castle behind. Over the roar of the battle, the spells, the screams, the cries of the injured, Kingsley picked a set of steps coming closer from behind. The steps stopped a bit behind him, and he wondered what that person was doing. What were they doing if they weren't joining him nor helping move people to the infirmary? The harpies descended two more times. Tonks let out a very colorful curse involving the harpies' sexual habits. She also cast a curse and threw a rock. Perhaps if someone were to stay behind without taking action, they would be able to see that there was a certain rhythm to the harpy's assault. If one were to stay calm and remain back, if they had an ear for music, they could pick the subtle hints from the flap of their wings in the air. They could predict to the second the moment in which they would come flying through the broken doors once more.
"Duck!"
said a musical voice. Kingsley ducked. First lesson in aura training, you heard duck and you better have your mouth on the floor in a second. He heard glass breaking. He had been hearing it for the last 20 minutes, but this time was different. It wasn't glass from the windows, but from a bottle. You had to know the difference when you were an auror. The bottle broke, and from it erupted a fire that quickly grew into a wall just as the harpies were coming, too fast and too late to stop or change course. Kingsley got up, saw that Tonks was indeed alive and smiling faintly, saw Snape standing there with two more bottles in his hands.
"Use them sparingly," he said, handing them the bottles. "East and south entrances are holding."
"And the west?"
"They had to collapse the ceiling behind them as they retreated. Technically, the harpies didn't get inside because there was no more inside."
The flames were still burning. Kingsley felt his eyes prickling with the smoke.
It'll be a pity to lose this position, too. We won't have any good spots to protect the doors from above.
Severus nodded. Goyle and Bulstrode are coming with a cauldron full of tar. That should help things.
They would.
Kingsley nodded at him in gratitude, for the help and for the fact that he had not said a word about this awful blunder, gratitude for the fact the corridor behind him was almost empty. They had gotten all the injured away. Now there was only the roar of the fire. The infirmary was like a beehive or an anthill, apparently chaotic from a distance, but in truth a perfectly tuned machine full of movement and light. Usually the infirmary was the quietest room in the castle, tied with the library, but now it was full of action. Someone hovering over the castle would have no problem finding the room. If they refrained from smashing the windows and killing the people nearby, they could get a good look at the patients laying in their beds. Gilray said that there was a white virgin as a reward for whoever located the woman who had cast the spells outside. The floor was full of blood. Someone had brought a couple of buckets of sawdust and tossed it around so it wouldn't be slippery. Usually they would just evanescale everything, but there weren't that many casters in the infirmary, and they couldn't be put on cleaning duty. The sawdust worked. They had many injured, and any other time they would have been so overworked that half of them would have bled to death before receiving treatment. Any other time they would have insisted on giving magical medicine exclusively, and they would have failed. But it was near the end of year, and Pomfrey's group was formed with refugees, people who had their wands taken or never had one to begin with, and had survived on the run with whatever they had at hand. A few drops of Dittany could close any open wound, and you didn't need any magic for that. A potion to give back strength and stimulate blood replenishment could be brewed beforehand. Slowly the infirmary became less loud as all the patients were treated. A few of them even insisted that they felt well enough to go back to fighting, and even if they had only been cut and weren't missing big parts, they were allowed to go. They only had so many beds. Emmeline Vance was in one of them with Pomfrey and Susanna Newhouse working on her, desperately trying to get her stabilized. Elderberry was checking on Susan Bones, who had been dead for a few seconds before her heart began beating again, probably after Pomfrey grabbed Death by the ears and twisted them hard to make it go, because there was no other explanation to how she had managed to pull off that miracle. Richard Brent was sitting in bed. The sleeping draft he had been given had worn off, and he was now considering whether to try to sleep again or slip out, risk Susanna's anger, and go help on the front lines. He could also stay there and help in another way, holding hands and bringing water to dry and feverish lips, and maybe Susanna would be angry at him for being out of bed, but she was bound to be grateful too. Gregory Goyle was sitting next to his friend. He had a bleeding cut on the forehead that had been considered of little importance. Crab was in the worst condition. While the three cuts on his arm weren't too deep, the harpy had pulled with such force that she had dislocated his shoulder and torn some muscles there. Vincent insisted that he was fine, but he was also grateful for the presence of his friend. And in a corner, sharing a bed because they were short on them, the Caro siblings slept the deep slumber of fairy tales. The screams of pain and the smell of blood had reached them, and it was giving them interesting dreams. No one had ever counted how many rooms Hogwarts had. Some Ravenclaw headmasters had tried to get a comprehensive inventory of the castle spaces, and none of them had succeeded. The closest was the Marauder's map, and even that was missing some rooms and secret tunnels. A broad estimation would say that there were over 1,000 different rooms. The Harpies had quickly found the one that interested them. Gilray had promised them a virgin. Whiten stopped to think where she could have gotten such a prize. She had been working with the wizard for months now, and to them anyone out of the mountains had natural access to that kind of exquisite delicacy. 6 harpies fell over the infirmary windows, breaking them. One of them lost her grasp and slid down the wall. She most likely opened her wings in time to avoid a big fall. The other 5 got inside the room. One of them came perilously close to Susanna Newhouse, who hadn't even lifted her eyes at the commotion, focused as she was on saving Emmeline Vance. That harpy was bludgeoned with a stool by Richard Brent. He didn't kill her, but he didn't stop hitting her until he was sure she wouldn't be a threat anymore. He saved 2 lives with that, at least 2 lives. He saved Susanna's, who had been right in the line of the harpy's claws, and she saved Emmeline Vance. A 4th harpy was stopped by Gregory Goyle, who tackled her to the ground for daring to come too close to his friend. The world was becoming more and more confusing, and Gregory liked the comfort of having his friends around to explain things. She slashed his face and his sides terribly, but pain had little effect on Gregory. Pain he could understand. Death and friends going missing like Draco he could not. 3 harpies remained. 1 slashed at the closest person, scarlet droplets of blood spurting from the new wound. She hissed and attacked again, this time to the one on the other side. Then she opened her mouth to let out a paralyzing scream and only got a squeak as she was transformed into a very angry sparrow. Having shut down the transfiguration cord, McGonagall had relented and gone to the infirmary to have her arm healed. She had already got it in an improvised sling, and her wand arm remained perfectly in use. Arthur Weasley was also there, sent by Snape to get a recent report on the injured and whatever Pomfrey needed. He hit one of the harpies with a quick series of blasting spells. One of them missed and made a big hole in the wall, although not so big that they could see through it. The harpy kept trying to get away, but after 2 more hits, she finally came to a stop. But the 6th one was nimbler and hungrier than her sisters. She jumped to the ceiling and crawled over it, bypassing the first line of people in the infirmary. Of course, everybody saw the adult-sized harpy advancing on the ceiling, but she still got some vital seconds while they were distracted with the others. McGonagall cast a spell, dark gray and smoky, but she missed. Arthur, too, let out a stream of white light, but the harpy deflected it with her wings. If it hurt her, it certainly didn't do enough to stop her. More people were turning around and shooting at her as the threat of the others was dealt with. But it was still the infirmary in which few could use a wand, and those who could had patients to treat. She twirled in the air, easily evading their hexes, and landed in a corner of the infirmary. She had to know that there was no escape from there. She was too far from the window and the door, only she was exactly where she wanted to be. True, the harpies had never wanted or expected to get further inside the castle. What for? Closed grounds were to their disadvantage. But she had fought to get where she was because that's where her prize was. She was so enthralled by the promise of a white virgin with a milky smell and the reddest blood that she didn't stop to consider what she would do next, only that she would complete Gilray's request and earn her reward. Given the events of the night and the day before, they had all forgotten about the permanent residents of the healing ward, the siblings of pain. They had all forgotten, and they didn't even understand at first what it meant when the harpy extended a hand that was like a claw and slashed Damocus's neck. The blood came gushing out of the wound like a fountain, and just because it was Amicus Caro, it wasn't any less terrible. They sent multiple spells at her because even if they didn't understand what she was doing, they could see that it wasn't good. Their cries as they cast the spells weren't enough to drown out the sound of Amicus Caro choking on his own blood. She was there, right in the corner. They could barely miss this time, but it was too late. The harpy fell to the floor, dying but still struggling to get back up. In her right claw, she was clutching Electo's heart, freshly ripped from her chest. Until her very last moment, she still tried to go back to Gilray and give it to her. The harpy died, and so did Electo and Amicus Caro, and with them the wards they had put around the castle. The ones that didn't let any human step through fizzled and went away. Hogwarts's greatest protection against Death Eaters had just disappeared.
I am so glad that the harpies didn't get further in, said Severus Snape, his head hanging low and resting over his folded arms on the table. It did not have the charm of Luna Lovegood's optimistic sentences. Maybe in a bit, when she was due to get up, she could tell them something nice. It was close to 4 in the morning. Severus was tired, he had a terrible headache, and he was very thirsty, although he didn't know that. He also had a castle with giants and trolls banging at the doors, harpies lashing at anyone who got close to the windows, a flock of firebirds who had gone crazy with the harpies' screams, and, according to the ghosts, a pack of werewolves running through the forest at top speed in the direction of the castle. It turned out the attacks on the centaurs had been carried out by ogres after all. Yet another thing in which he was right, and it was for nothing.
"There are no vampires," said Sirius, who was better at this.
In his mind, silently, he added that there was no Harry or Remus or the little kids, and all of that was good. They had lost their biggest defense, though. That was bad. Those who were resting but not sleeping had been called to join them because, for a minute, When they realized the significance of what had happened, they had all believed that Voldemort was going to enter Hogwarts that very instant. The one sleeping would rise soon, undamaged and unworn. Having people rest had been a good idea, even if they were not going to sleep any more this night.
"Keep doing as you are," said Kingsley Shacklebolt. He had a nice voice, deep and velvety. He did not use it as well as Severus, but it was nice all the same. "You are doing well," he added, and this time he had exactly the right timbre. "I will start preparing the defense against humans and human-like. You keep working against the others. We can still pull this through."
Severus raised his head a bit so he could nod.
"Have that side," he said, pointing at one side of the professor's common room. He stretched his neck as he got up. That's all they could do. Get up and go back to work.
"Fred, George," called Kingsley Shacklebolt. "You know the castle better than anyone. You're on patrol duty protecting the secret passages in case they try coming from there. Black, dueling with Diggle and Arthur. He's still up in the infirmary. Tonks with Molly and Ezekiel. Moody, you have Fletcher."
He ignored the simultaneous groans from both Moody and Mundungus.
"And the young Elderberry. I will give backup to all of you as soon as required."
Everybody got up and started to group as ordered.
"Remember, this is going to be a long fight. Don't try to get a quick win. They have the numbers, but we have the terrain on our side."
"Oh, did we tell you about the Horcruxes?"
asked Sirius suddenly.
"I don't remember if we did."
"The what?"
"We didn't."
"Voldemort is virtually unkillable unless a series of objects that have a piece of his soul are destroyed first," Severus summarized. "Ah, Mr. Weasley, you're here."
He nodded to Ron, who returned the greeting calmly. Kingsley looked worn by the news, but determined.
"This changes nothing. We will still protect the castle and don't let them take it. Now everybody to the ground floor and the entrance is there." "Don't bother. The ground is full of trolls. You won't get a single hit with them in the way," said a new voice, firm and collected.
Everyone's wand rose instantly except for Sirius, who was beaming, and Severus, who was taking a glass of water. Percy was there. Percy Weasley, with his official ministry robes open and wearing underneath something very unlike Percy. His hair was a riot of bouncing curls. He hadn't cut his hair in a while, so he looked a bit like a classical sculpture, except for the glasses.
"Purse?"
Fred hadn't seen Percy in such a state since the week of the newts.
"Also, the orders are all wrong. I didn't hear them very well, but they're wrong. Hello, Fred. Is Oliver here? Oliver's coming. He'll be able to direct you better. They're coming with harpies and dementors."
"We noticed, funnily enough," pointed out Ron dryly. "And the dementors are not a problem anymore."
"No?"
Percy looked down at his watch and stared at it intently, almost as if he had forgotten how to read the hours.
"Right, no. The time of bronze, the time of silver are gone. Then is the time of blood."
"Dear Merlin, he has snapped. I knew this would happen,"
George confided to Fred. Molly let out a soft, "Oh." The truth was that she didn't know how to react to the sudden presence of Percy. They had learnt to live with his absence before the war started, and they had learnt not to be afraid for him. He was the only one who was safe in the ministry.
"Percival, it is good to see you,"
Kingsley started to say gently. He was a tough leader, but he also knew how to be patient with people.
"But I think it might be better if you just sit here and..."
"Not now, Minister. I have a lot to organize,"
Percy snapped as he went further inside the room and dropped a plastic bag in front of Severus Snape. Severus hooked a finger on the bag to look inside as if nothing extraordinary were happening. Then again, Severus never looked surprised by anything.
"Minister?"
"Maybe he is petite with the Confundus," suggested Daedalus Diggle.
"Somehow I always knew he would be the one to go insane. Come on, Fred, help me get him."
Molly covered her mouth with her hand and took comfort in Tonks's hand on her back. The way Percy was acting was highly reminiscent of Barty Crouch Sr. when they found him wandering dizzily around the Forbidden Forest. That was the last they saw of him before his own son killed him. It looked as if Percy had escaped from an equally mad imprisonment. The way Moody narrowed his eyes said that he was thinking around similar lines.
"Percival!"
called Kingsley in a commanding tone. Severus had extracted an iron nail from the plastic bag and looked oddly satisfied about it. This didn't foretell anything good, because Snape also looked on the verge of a nervous collapse. Percy was looking at the papers extended over the table.
"What?"
he said. He had mastered the dry tone. "I am Head Auror Kingsley Shacklebolt, Percy Dem. I fear you may be a bit confused."
"Am I? Why?"
Percy turned around to look at Kingsley as if he had just been told that he had a spelling mistake in one of his reports. "You thought I was the minister."
"Oh."
Percy stared at Kingsley before blinking quickly and looking around him. Kingsley had strategically put himself between Percy and the others. Moody had shuffled to the door.
"Right, not yet. It is difficult sometimes. Lately, I don't know when I am."
"You're in Hogwarts."
"Yes, yes, of course I'm in Hogwarts. I know where I am. Do you take me for an obtuse imbecile?"
The spelling mistake wasn't such, and he was now properly indignant.
"It is when. When?"
"I don't..." He stopped mid-sentence, as if someone had called him to draw his attention. For a second, it looked as if the blue of his eyes had turned white while he looked past Kingsley and beyond the room. If there was a smell of rosemary, it was so faint that it went unnoticed. There was also a draft of air that tossed Percy's curls, but no one else's.
"You," he said in a guttural growl.
If Percy were to murder someone, this was exactly how they would expect him to sound. Which was ironic, because the times he had had to kill people, he didn't sound like that. He was looking at Fred, who had taken a prudent step back, because never in his life of mischief had he been on the end of such a stare. In two strides, Percy was before him, grabbing his lapels with his right hand. Fred was shorter and stockier, and shouldn't have had any trouble pushing Percy away. He lifted a hesitating hand to Percy's arm, and he still found himself walking backwards as Percy pushed him towards a corner. Percy's eyes were blue, nothing but blue. It was silly to think that a minute ago they had been white. They were murderous, though. Fred had no doubt of that. There was the outline of a skull in his pupils. Fred's back touched the stone wall.
"Percy, step back!"
Percy's arm was surprisingly firm as he pressed Fred against the wall. He was looking to the room, though, to George and the others who had come closer. Not Severus, though. He was still examining the iron nails Percy had brought and didn't seem to care that a murder was developing mere steps away from him.
"Step back!"
he repeated, wand high and ready. They stepped back. Everybody had their wand in their hand. Kingsley and Moody immediately tried to find a position out of Percy's sight to cast Stupefy. Tonks's arm pushed Molly gently but firmly away so she wouldn't see. There was now a big empty area in the professor's common room, between Percy in the corner and everyone else. Fred took three deep breaths that carried his confusion and surprise. He had a wall on his back and on his side, and his immediately older brother right in front, pushing him as if he wanted to embed him in the wall. Deep breaths, 1, 2, 3. And then came the explosion. Not an explosion per se, but it felt like one. The glass of the windows broke into a million little pieces, followed by three harpies and the worst screech they had heard all night. There was a flash of red light, purple in the border, moving in an arc like a whip. It was one of Bellatrix's favorite curses, and she executed it with great mastery. Percy's was somehow different, while still having a crisp cleanliness. A harpy's head fell to the floor and rolled over the glass shards to the middle of the room. The body to which it had been attached was slumped over the windowsill. There was a severed arm ending in a claw by the farthest window. The headless body had two arms, so this one had to belong to someone else. Of course, they didn't know that the harpies had been made a promise for the night, and that they were intent on getting everything out of it and would fight with ferocity until sunrise. All they knew was that there had been three harpies in the room, and now there were not. And Fred. Fred knew. Others might not realize it, but he knew very well where he had been standing less than a minute ago. There was a big puddle of blood to mark the spot. If he had stayed there. Percy's body and his iron arm between him and the room was suddenly much less threatening. He was also lowering his wand and taking a deep breath, and when he turned to look at Fred, his eyes were very different. They made Fred think of the sky in a place very far away,
Maybe the sky in Egypt, where the blue had been hot and unforgiving.
Do you know what flaying is?
I can't remember at the moment, but listen, Fred. I am pretty sure that it is painful. And if you don't do exactly what I say, I will flay you alive.
Fred was hearing the words, and he actually remembered the meaning of flaying because Filch had made that threat multiple times. He could hear the firmness in Percy's word, and he could also see in his eyes that he would never do so. A hard and sonorous blow, however, a slap across the face, that may very well be. Fred could see that.
Go with George and stay together, you hear me? You two stay together and never be more than 50 steps apart. You do not work in different places. You do not get out of each other's sights. Oliver will tell you what to do.
Got it, promised Fred. Stay with George, that was easy. That came naturally to them in any case.
And forget about the corridors. Sirius will do that.
Okay, said Sirius.
And absolutely no dueling Bellatrix Lestrange, he said, raising his voice. Not you, and certainly not you. She will kill every single person who engages her. Just don't duel her. Miss Tonks, I'm talking to you. She will kill you in a particularly gruesome manner.
There was blood coming still from the open neck of the harpy. It made a glub, glub, glub sound as it fell on the floor, exactly the kind of sound that helped to keep an audience enthralled.
The problem of the hour will be the harpies still. There won't be any Death Eaters until the sunrise.
He looked around quickly as if wanting to remind himself of the place and time.
I'm going to bed. You too.
Severus rose an eyebrow and nodded without arguing, to everyone's further surprise. He was still holding the iron nails, and he looked very satisfied.
Isn't anyone going to ask? Okay, I have to ask, said Sirius. Percy, darling, what are you wearing?
Percy blinked and easily ignored the darling. Sirius had once called him the most noble man on earth right before he punched him, so darling coming from the mouth of the very attractive and electric Sirius Black was nothing. Percy looked down.
Oh.
Oh, he said a bit sadly and mostly tiredly. He was so tired.
I forgot I had these on.
It is not easy to live multiple lives at the same time, to see not just one future, but the many futures that may come. He looked at his clothes. It's not like he hadn't had a warning and knew about the importance of today. He could have dressed for the occasion, put on some nice robes, and get his curls in order so he would look the part, all handsome and heroic. But Percy had been lost in thought back then, just as he was now, so after he came home that weird evening that seemed so long ago, he took a shower and put on clothes automatically. Frankly, he counted it as a success that he had come dressed at all to the big climactic battle. At least now he understood why it had been so cold in the train station.
"They are called yoga pants," he said, pointing at his thigh.
Then he grabbed at the hem of his shirt with both hands. It was purple with a golden print of a lotus flower.
So was the shirt. They're very comfortable.
They do look comfortable, Sirius agreed. You can sleep in them.
Yes, I will do that now. Don't duel Bellatrix Black. Did I tell you that?
Percy looked suddenly very tired and ashen, as if getting a look at his clothes had reminded him of all the work he had done and all there was still to do.
You made it clear, Sirius assured him.
Fred and George were now standing next to each other. The presence of their twin had always been reassuring.
What's happening?
Asked Tonks in a loud whisper. Tonks was nice. Percy didn't listen to Sirius's explanation of Galahad's actions and identity. Fred was all right. He was alive. He had been close to death for so long, and now the moment, that terrible moment that used to cover Percy in acrid sweat, had passed. It had been the biggest thing in his life for years, and now it had passed. And there were many other big things, but he was so tired. He left the room and went to sleep in the first quiet classroom he could find. He went half blind, because now that Fred was not dead, his vision was going all wonky. There were three other moments in which Fred could die, but he wouldn't. As long as he stayed close to George, he wouldn't, and Percy had driven his point. The explosion, the stray curse, the knife.
Percy had seen all of them, not knowing what would trigger them, what chain of events would bring one and not the other. He had seen, and he had noticed that George, or Fred until now he hadn't known which one, wasn't there. The twin would die away from his brother, and that made it all the more wrong. Those images flashed over Percy's eyes for the last time, never to be seen again unless he brought them back in nightmares. Goodbye, vision of his brother dying. Goodbye. There were other flashes. Some of them knew because now that Fred was all right and was going to keep being all right, there was a nice empty space to be filled with visions. Look at Ronald go. Good lad, Ronald. Look at Longbottom jumping headfirst into death. Very bad. But there was daylight in that vision, so Percy could wait until then to go find the boy and tell him no. It was the early morning of Friday, and Percy had been going mad since Tuesday's afternoon. He fell gratefully into a divan and was instantly asleep, his pupils still moving quickly under his eyelids.
Sorry, boys. I would have told you, but we promised not to. Manny had just done us a really big favor. The men Achilles and the Ministry, are in transport. So if he asked for a bit of discretion, that's the least we could do. That and keeping an eye on you both, and I'm happy to say that neither of you has been mutilated.
There was something very upsetting about Sirius Black explaining something. It was the confirmation that he wasn't a complete self-centered oaf, that there was a smart and capable mind behind all the insanity. People didn't like it. It made them question their judgment.
You see, apparently it's all very funny, but Mooney wouldn't explain why. Severinus also knows, apparently. Did you notice? He was not surprised at all. Probably get it, the bastard. Something about the name Galahad. Nice name. I like all the A's, but you don't see what's the deal with it. Anyway, I recommend doing whatever he says because he can see the future. I should have started with that. I see it now. No need to make that face, Moody. Percy can see the future, and he wants to get a good one. Let's follow his advice. There.
Sirius beamed at all of them. His hands were on each of the twins' shoulders. Seeing his friendly attitude with the twins was also distressing. People had never considered the possibility of those three coming together, and seeing that it had already happened produced a feeling similar to having missed the big red comet that preluded the end of times.
"Iron nails," said Severus simply to Professor Slughorn, who had just come to their floor from a secret tunnel in the dungeons.
The main floor was taken by trolls, but the dungeons didn't have many of them, and the house elves had locked themselves in the kitchen. Slughorn looked with surprise at the plastic bag Severus had put on his chest. He opened it carefully, as if he had been told that it contained something very precious.
"What do you think? Moses of Alexandria's cure against curses?"
suggested Slughorn as he took one nail and examined it with the same careful appreciation Severus had shown earlier.
"Perhaps. Also Alkindus's remedy for major injuries. See what Poppy says about it. I'm out for this shift."
Slughorn nodded and changed direction to go to the infirmary. A nice bag of old iron nails. Dropped in certain potions, it could help strengthen their effects. Good against some dark creatures, and also good to accelerate healing from magical wounds. If the harpy's claws were considered magical, these nails came at the right time. In the typical tradition of siblings, the Weasley children had gone from "Percy is an idiot and we hate him" to "How dare you doubt my brother, you heathen." They had now formed a new group and were making sure that no troll managed to get up to the first floor. The trolls and the couple of ogres there weren't that much of a problem. The werewolves coming might be because they were actually capable of understanding the function of a flight of stairs. However, the biggest problem was still the harpies, just as Percy had said. Whenever they saw any movement in a window, they attacked, and they hadn't stopped their assault on the infirmary just because the Carrows were dead. McGonagall was very displeased about it, and also doing a great job of protecting the place with Arthur Weasley. The Firebirds were going mad, and the little cloister where they were cooped had turned into a small hell. The stone was holding well, but they had melted the lead bars used in the frames of the windows. It was decided, not only by Ron, but by Sinistra, too, to let the birds out. They didn't look well-trained enough to actually be discerning in their targets, so there was a good chance that they would attack the harpies, rather than the inhabitants of the castle, since they were making the most noise. They also knew how to bring them back if they became too much of a problem. They threw a couple of sacks worth of grain into a big cauldron of wine, and they dispelled the charms locking the birds. Hagrid, his big beard smoking and his moleskin coat full of burns, waved them away and told them to play nice. The roof of the divination tower immediately caught on fire. It didn't look like such a great idea then. The harpies did stop attacking the southeast side of the castle, though, so that was something. They had reached that point in which a roof on fire was somehow better than the monsters coming through the windows. Such monsters, too. They were tireless and fearless, and even when they managed to get a good hex on them, they still came back with their claws and their teeth and those leathery wings with protruding bones. They came and they hacked and they slashed, and if you weren't quick, if you fell and no one dragged you inside, then they came to you and took their treats, heart, liver, spleen. They hadn't gotten much of them, actually, or at all. They spilled blood and took some limbs, but other than the Caro's heart, that she didn't even get to taste, they hadn't gotten any of the wonderful presents they had been promised. This made them angrier and wilder. This made them all the more determined to gain some big spoils. The Ravenclaw Tower was close to the infirmary, and in there they had set up a small laboratory to brew any potion that had an extremely short shelf life or that needed to be taken hot. They didn't need a big laboratory, thankfully, but they still needed this one to provide better treatment. And when you have people who have lost so much blood and chunks of flesh, you want to treat them right. It wasn't so big, and it wasn't very well lit, but it was there. At the moment, they had two squibs and three witches who had their wands taken by the ministry. Two Muggleborns, one half-blood, and Luna, sweet, wonderful Luna, who came with the famous iron nails and Pomfrey's petition that they heat four more blood-replenishing potions. The other witches might have been bigger or fatter or sweeter, but no one had hair like Luna's, woven with silver and gold. It is a fact that flying creatures, creatures with wings from the magpie to the dragon, like pretty shiny things. The window to the Ravenclaw Tower was ripped right out of its stone frame. Four claws darted inside, sinking their talons into the white flesh, and pulled. Julietta, who had the fortune of having black hair and black skin that made her almost invisible in the dark room, she was the closest to them. She alternated hitting one leathery arm with grabbing at Luna's arms and dress and pulling back. She had nothing to do against the strength of two adult harpies, and so she saw them open their wings and jump out of the window, dragging Luna with them. Luna had blood rivulets coming down her arms and her sides, like tiny mountain creeks on a map. Her eyes were wide open with fear and surprise, and she was not screaming. They were taking her, and she was not crying out. Julietta saw a big red ball come down from the sky and hit one of the harpies right in the face, breaking her nose and snapping her head back. Her grip on Luna loosened, and the girl almost got her left arm free, which wasn't particularly good when she was at least 5 floors high in the air. Then there was a shadow. Julietta didn't see it well, only that it passed before her really quick and was lost in the darkness below. She was distracted by the very bright stream of white light that hit the other harpy right in the chest, jolting her just like an electric shock. Julietta was Muggleborn. The harpy let go of Luna. Her claws and wings were shaking and failing her. She let go of Luna, who was now dangling just from her hand. The one harpy holding her looked dizzy and had blood coming down from her nose. She opened her claw. Luna plummeted down because she looked deceivingly weightless, like a gentle spirit, but she was a real girl of flesh and blood and bone, and when she dropped, she fell like humans do. She didn't scream this time either, just a short, "Oh." In that moment, Julietta wanted nothing more than to see the world burn, to kill those horrible harpies and see them die in the worst kind of pain, but also to kill the man who sent them, and all the wizards and witches that followed him. In that moment, she would have broken the whole world if she could, just to have them die. In that moment, it looked like nothing good or beautiful could live for long, so she might as well burn it all and stop the pain. In that moment, all her suffering became hate, a hate that consumed her and would have killed her. "This is so nice. I haven't gone flying in too long." The harpies that had taken Luna were hit with 2 more spells. Or maybe it was 4 or 6, who cared? Enough to send them down, to see them fall. One of them struggling and desperately trying to make her wings work, the other one falling like a stone. They went down just as Luna came up, sitting on a broomstick.
eyes closed and face turned upwards to enjoy the cold air. Julieta noticed with breathless gratefulness that there was a strong arm holding Luna around the waist. The other arm held a wand because Angelina Johnson was a serious Quidditch player and a good chaser, and she could control a broom just with her legs really well. Only someone standing on top of the astronomy tower would see it. And there was nobody there because of the firebirds. But if there had been, they would have gotten the kind of view that makes it into epic poetry. They had arrived in an arrow formation with Oliver at the head. The Gryffindor Quidditch team, scrambling their brains for memories of places up north where they could apparate, and when that wasn't enough, just flying over the mountains and the forest and right into Hogwarts. The fire in the divination tower, a beacon that saved them an hour of flight. Now they were here, and they were higher than the harpies, and above all, they were disciplined and well-organized. It was just five of them. Lee was on the back of Oliver's broom. Five against dozens and dozens of harpies and the demented firebirds and their indiscriminate attacks. But as Oliver had quickly realized,
"Because flaying strategy matters. Shut up, all of you."
They were just five against dozens of individual harpies, but they were not against a proper flying army. Other than those two they had just downed, harpies didn't seem capable of much collaboration. Just as Angelina assented, with Luna sitting astride her arms. Oliver's group fell over the Ravenclaw Tower and cleared it of any harpies attacking it.
"Yes, the twins are here,"
Luna was happily telling Angelina.
"They'll be very happy to see you. They're fine."
"Well, we're being attacked by Voldemort's forces, but we're fine."
"Oh my God, come here, you,"
mumbled a still pale Julieta as she pulled Luna aside. The bleeding on her arms had mostly stopped after completely dyeing her arms red. Luna said that she looked like a ladybug. That was it, no allusion to hidden ladybug's power or arcane rituals. She just thought that she looked like one, and it was interesting to share.
"No, Oliver, I have a hammer. I just hit one of those weird women with my hammer. Don't put me on the ground."
Oliver made Lee get off the broom all the same. He left him in the astronomy tower, however, which had the best views of the castle. Someone with a megaphone or the spell Sonorous could see where the Air Force was needed and send them there.
"The divination tower is on fire, but it's not like we ever cared for it. We can let it burn. Cluster of harpies on the sixth floor, east wing. Mallard's pants, that was Angelina Johnson, everyone, setting four harpies on fire. What a woman. This is Lee Jordan calling the Battle of Hogwarts, everyone."
Few werewolves had managed to cross the charms protecting Hogwarts before they were dispelled with Electo's death. It seemed that there was too much human in them, despite what they had always been told and what they themselves wanted to believe. A werewolf wasn't human. A werewolf was something more, stronger, faster, hungrier. Yet only three of them had the endurance to go through the spell, and they paid a very high price for it. Roma Santa, having performed the feat twice already in less than 24 hours, did it again for the third and last time. His body was too weakened from the strain, and when he went to draw the centaurs away from the giants, he found death in their bows and under their hooves. Such is the spirit of war. One day you are a hero and your actions change the tide of battle. The next day you die a simple, nameless death. Not being able to pass the charms was an insult to their nature. They made up for it by crossing the forest at full speed and arriving at Hogwarts with the force of a battle ram. Werewolves weren't animals, but tonight they wanted to be, and they unleashed the worst of human nature. Fenrir Greyback was their leader. He had put them in two groups, one on the south entrance, the other on the west, with instructions to meet in the middle of the castle, and only when they had left a bloody path behind them. It was the hour of the wolf, the hour of the fangs sinking into the flesh. Forget the harpies and their claws. Forget the wizards that were only now beginning to arrive. This was their time, and they would make it count. Show everyone that the werewolf ought to be respected. Fenrir jumped over the fallen corpse of the giant chieftain that was still obstructing the main door. He dodged around the trolls that were wandering in confusion around the empty ground floor, and even lashed at one of them when he didn't move aside quick enough. The smell of blood. Even the greenish one of a troll aroused his senses in a rage that was hunger and was lust. The others followed him, equally excited by the sight and the smell of spilled blood, and unlike the trolls around them, they knew how to climb up the stairs.
how to dodge the spells cast by the wizards on top, how to leap over the last few steps and fall over the pretty witch with a bow in her hair.
I didn't like those firebirds much at first, but they just ate one harpy, so they're all right. And if you look out a west window, you might get a look at one of the twins. Gosh, how much I've missed them. I was worried sick. The harpies are trying to send Alicia and Kate to the ground, but the twins are having none of it, and yes, our girls just put out the fire on the roof there.
Lee Jordan lowered his megaphone for a second to get a sip of water from the glass someone had brought him. He also dried the sweat from his forehead, and once the harpy that was climbing up the wall got closer, he knocked her in the head with his hammer. Of course, they had also tried flying right to the top of the astronomy tower and take him from there, but Lee could see them, and he had a megaphone and a Quidditch team that was quite fond of him. Fred and George were absolutely terrific with their beater's bats, and they moved as if they had just one mind. Not a single harpy got close to him that way. Not that they had much luck attacking him from below. Over by the Gryffindor Tower, Oliver was yelling instructions to the new arrivals. Cho Chang didn't look like she was up for flying, given the black scar that marred her face and the bandages on her neck and arm. But she also didn't look like she was going to listen, so Oliver had her with Duncan Ingleby protecting Ravenclaw Tower and the brewery there. Of course, fighting the harpies would be easier if there wasn't a full flock of firebirds flying around, but they were working on bringing them back to a closed inner patio where Hagrid had prepared them a nice dinner consisting of wine-soaked wheat and acorns.
Three harpies on your back, Oliver. There you go. And they're flocking by the second floor again. Don't really know why. There's like half a harpy hanging from one of the windows there. I'm told a Weasley did it. Can't say that surprises me.
There are more people coming.
Uh-huh, said Ron for all answer. He was keeping two werewolves, who looked nothing like Professor Lupin, at bay with blasting charms, while at the same time holding a bleeding lavender brown in his arms.
Mr. Aberforth Dumbledore from the Hogshead sent a message via Patronus to Mr. Kingsley Shacklebolt,
nearly headless Nick went on. He was helping, like many of the ghosts he was helping. He was certainly more helpful than Professor Binns, who yesterday went to give class as usual, even though the headmaster had cancelled them. But there was also something very obstructive in his way of helping, mostly the way he spoke. The Bloody Baron was scary and seemed like he was considering killing you in your sleep, but at least he got to the point quickly.
Seamus!
Barked Ron, not really listening to what Aberforth, Kingsley, or nearly headless Nick had to say. He had lost the stairs between the ground and the first floor, and was fighting to keep the corridor and the stairs at the end of it that led to the second floor.
Mr. Aberforth says that we may expect a small but constant stream of reinforcements. He has been contacted by other witches and wizards wishing to come to Hogwarts to help.
Bloody brilliant, said Ron, although he was probably referring to the small explosion Seamus had just created that sent the two werewolves flying backwards. Now he could get Lavender the treatment she needed.
Yes, I thought so too. Mr. Kingsley wanted me to let you and Mr. Sirius know. Shall I direct the new arrivals your way?
Yes. Yes. Said Ron quickly. The first yes was directed to the two house elves Pansy Parkinson had called to evacuate Lavender. The second yes was for Nick, because you didn't grow up in the Weasley household without learning how to multitask and hold three conversations at once. The way Nick spoke, it seemed as if there were a dozen brave old wizards wanting to die honorably with them, and to be fair, Aberforth had made it sound that way with his bunch of fools and will arrive as they come. The truth was a bit different, because it involved two popular Slytherins with connections. In essence, it was just a bunch of fools coming to Hogwarts and certain death. Matsuruchi Tsubanda was very judicious and selective over the people she contacted. Wanting Voldemort's defeat was a requisite, but it certainly wasn't the only one, otherwise there would be more trouble than help. She had a list of names, and she also had Marcus Flint in the outskirts of Hogsmeade helping people get to the Hogshead or to the Shrieking Shack. However, they preferred to get to Hogwarts.
He is mine,
said the very first name on Subado's list. Nick had told Ron about them, and that was good, helpful, but he hadn't told them who exactly was coming, which was why Nick's help was so frustrating. Fleur Delacour was an incredibly pretty girl, but physical beauty was just one thing. Her voice, on the other hand, was quite average, and in this moment it had sounded like a particularly enraged frog or demon-possessed doll.
You must de merde, you cannot!
Also, she was quite foul-mouthed in French. Really, the image of the delicate flower came because she was blonde and French and had a certain bone structure. But the actual Fleur was made of murdering gasoline. Everyone jumped aside, opening a path for her to go to Fenrir Greyback, who had stopped in his tracks in surprise.
Vat de verfoot, putain!
Kill is a word too small for what Fleur did to Fenrir Greyback. He died. No, he died for sure. But in a way, he was more dead than necessary. 110% dead, so to speak, as if Fleur had killed him 3 times. Bill followed his future wife, and together they helped seal the corridor and lay a nasty curse for whoever tried to come this way again.
"That's all of you, isn't it?" asked Seamus, still panting from the fight. "All the Weasleys. No, there's another one, Charlie. Ah, what's he do? He's a dragon tamer."
Seamus, Neville, and Hannah Abbott all looked up through the window. It didn't look like there was any space for a dragon to join the airborne battle. Sunrise came slowly and on tiptoes. Sunrise came to reveal a castle with smoking roofs and broken windows and doors. Sunrise showed just how many people were laying in the beds of the infirmary, and how many more should be resting there but weren't because their injuries weren't bad enough. Sunrise showed the shadows under the eyes and the strain and the dust glued to the skin with sweat and blood. Sunrise showed a damaged castle and its dirty defendants. They hadn't noticed before, but they were dirty and smelly. Hagrid had just got back with all the firebirds. After the stress of the day before and the night full of action, the birds were happy to make themselves comfortable in a quiet cloister with just some statues for company. The moment they applied a darkness spell over them, they all got their heads under their wings and went to sleep. Without the firebirds, the light was now gentle and soft like a mother's touch. It was white and pink like a fairy's kiss. It was pretty. How perfectly unfair that they were the dirty-faced, sweaty, smelly people in the ugly castle. And they were the ones standing in the garden with the sunrise light falling over their silk robes and their silver masks. Voldemort was there. Nobody had seen him enter, and he was now standing 100 steps before the castle. A tall, dark figure that was so clean and well-cut. He was surrounded by his Death Eaters, all standing in formation around him, wands out and silver in their faces. It wouldn't last long, but for the moment they were beautiful and elegant, and looked deathly like the wings of the firebirds, or the claws of the harpies looked deathly. Percy had called it the time of diamond and coal. He didn't seem to be aware of how poetic his prophecies were. Voldemort was there, and he spoke with a sweet, gentle voice that was like the wind dragging the fallen leaves in a cemetery. He said that there would be no mercy. He said that they were all going to die, and their blood would wash their unclean essence from the air of Hogwarts. He sounded so rested, so full of energy. They had paced themselves, and they had done well. But they had been fighting for 12 hours now. They were injured and tired. They were taxed mentally, even if they were not physically exhausted. And they were at such a disadvantage against him, so tall and strong and dressed in impeccable silk. He said they were going to die, and it seemed like such a silly effort to put into a fight when they were all going to be killed either way. They might as well finish it early, lay down their wands and get to rest now forever. Voldemort was there, and they were going to die. But what Voldemort didn't know, couldn't know, was that it didn't matter. The people fighting him, they were not fighting to protect the school. It was not a battle for a strategic position, not really. It was a battle of ideas and morals, and so they would fight until their deaths, and if they could, they would fight after that, too. They would fight so that the younger children had extra time to escape, and they would fight so that the people following Voldemort were destroyed. If they fell doing so, so be it. They were prepared to die. Usually this is a good thing for the enemy, half their work is done. But not in this case, because it meant that they were not falling back, they were not fleeing. They would fight and erode Voldemort's strength. If not for them, for the others. So they would get a weakened Voldemort. As long as one of them survived, Voldemort would have lost. It sent the message that he would not walk without facing opposition, that he would not be tolerated, that people would resist and push back, always. It was, as Draco would say, about the meaning of things, about believing that someone was untouchable and about proving that he was not. The risk was worth it.
Severus was up, so was Percy. They had met by the window at the end of the corridor, two figures against the morning light coming in.
"I don't know," said Percy, because the unasked question was obvious. "So many things can happen. I don't know for sure."
"But is there a chance?"
"Oh, yes.
Yes, there is one chance. More than one if you accept certain people dying." Severus was a very clever man. He understood well what Percy had barely said. The toll that they would have to pay to bring the monster down. The desperation in trying to avoid it.
"He lives," said Percy, stretching his neck to one side and the other.
"No matter what, he lives. Now, the other one has gotten busy tonight, so I don't know. But he lives."
Severus was too afraid to ask which one lived for sure and which one might not. He saw why for many years the gift of prophecy had been considered a curse.
"You died," added Percy as he did something improbable with his arms, stretching them. "But you are alive, so I don't know. Don't get too close to the snake, I guess. There's a snake coming, very big. Almost killed my father once.
Nagini, his pet."
"Mm-hmm." Percy had taken two steps back and was sitting down on the floor.
"You have done extraordinarily well," said Severus at last, because he was a man that seldom let his feelings rob him of words. "I don't think anyone has thanked you yet."
Percy smiled softly.
I never expected any thanks, actually. But it is good to hear all the same. Thank you for that."
Voldemort had just stopped talking. His words were still hanging in the air. They both knew what he had to say, so they hadn't paid much attention.
"May I ask what you are doing?" Severus asked, turning his attention back inside.
"It is called sun salutation. You stretch your muscles and greet the sun as it rises."
Percy was making a perfect triangle, back and legs straight and the body folding by the waist. It was nice.
End of chapter 22. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.